But that thing you're talking about in terms of the allowing for ambivalence and ambiguity about individuals or anything, that it might not be good or bad, but both, I'd say that I've been wrestling with that for a long time. I mean, my whole life, but it's become more and more conscious as I've been looking at culture and my own influences, that I'm always trying to prove to myself that something is all bad. And that can only be because I want to find something that's all good. Because I mean, why would I wouldn't want to be surrounded by nothing but, you know, bad. Of course not. But I want to be able to separate the good from the bad, so then I can just orient towards the good. And that, put simply, that seems healthy and sane. But when I apply it to individuals or just the world, I can't do it. Can't separate the good from the bad individuals, and you can't separate the good from the bad within any given individual. Although, this is where Dave comes in, isn't it? Not because I think he's all good. And I think, you know, that is going to be an ongoing problem insofar as I keep looking to Dave or anyone to be somehow representing or embodying something that's all good. But that the orientation that he tries to uphold is an orientation towards the good, is a process of becoming 100% aligned with the good.
I don't approach it like that.
Mm.
Because I think that's preemptively trying to define what's happening with Dave. What I'm aware of is I've only experienced a very small part of it. And I'm not going to say exactly what it is, because I don't really need to.
Mm.
So I'm just open to learning more and experiencing more about it. Because it feels like the thing I've always wanted to do in my life. Is to know about what he knows about,
mm.
or what he's experiencing, at least. It's the thing I've always wanted to experience too. So I'm not thinking about it in terms of he is all good or he is all something, or I'm not really. It's sort of before any of those kind of ideas came into my mind.
So, well, what is the thing that you have always wanted then?
Well, that again, you're going to ask me to put it into words.
Yeah, well, I think you said wanted to know about. So,
I wanted to know about the thing that happens outside time. About how I exist outside time. About the person I am, I actually am, and was in a way before I was born.
Was that conscious though until more recently?
I dreamed about it, but I wouldn't ever have been able to put it into words. And in fact, me putting it into words now is not even really talking about it or communicating it.
Hmm. Right. Well, I suppose it's funny. It's kind of, it seems ironic somehow, because when I talk about it, when I just did anyway, but it seems generally now, I think because of the same concern that you have or awareness, I tend to try and simplify it to the point of being almost childlike, really. That's why I say orientation towards the good, because it's almost as though that, as close as I can get to neutralizing that part of me that wants to snarl everything up with words and concepts, if I just keep it to the point, on the edge of asinine.
Yeah, but I don't think that I don't think that carries too much of the transmission in it. I think that it's sort of inhibiting, and I think that what it communicates, a bit like when Dave uses spiritual language, it sort of inhibits some people's ability to get into what's happening, because they then start seeing Dave as a kind of moral. It's a kind of moral occurrence, and it is, but it's not. It's not sort of rule bound.
Mm.
I mean, I could only get a little glimpse looking at Dave. A little glimpse of his face, close up when he was looking at me. And that was enough. I couldn't even sustain it for very long. So energetic was the sense of being observed.
Did you say energetic was the sense of being observed?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It was a sense of observation, which I... it's like being burnt. Like looking at the sun.
Mm.
So I could only take a little look, like peeking through the curtains. So far be it from me to classify exactly what's there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even look at it.
Well, you said earlier it wasn't about seeing, but about feeling.
Yes, yeah.
With the sun as well. We can't really look at the sun, but we can always feel it.
Mm.
So are you aware of how much influence you've had on my own shift in focus and orientation?
Well, I remember you saying early on that it was quite validating after I'd initially, when you said that there was a free, Dave was having a free event and I went, and then I said, I said I was very impressed, and I remember you saying that you'd found that quite validating because it was a good sort of calibration of what you had been experiencing. So I'm aware that that has kind of set something in motion where you've started to be a bit more vocal about it. Because of having some corroboration.
Yeah, it's a particular kind of corroboration. It's two obvious things. One is that you came today via me, so you're somebody who was already attending to what I was doing and interested, and we've done a podcast, so you're kind of one of my people. That's obviously very key. And the other is the way in which you're able, the way the nature of your experience with Dave and the way in which you're able to communicate it. Like, it's not couched in spiritual language. It's very grounded. You're a carpenter. You're a Londoner, very down to earth in many ways, most ways, I'd say. Very skeptical. You're fully aware of the organized malevolence, all that. That's part of you being interested in my work, obviously. So it's like it has allowed me to see Dave through a different set of eyes, or with an added perspective. Like, if I only had three dimensions, then suddenly I have a fourth dimension. And well, it's mysterious, really. I just thought I'd mention it because my wife always says, bring it into the room. It's always good. Like, if we're doing this as this is a podcast, yeah, you can take some of the blame. for why I've been encouraged, you know, emboldened to risk the criticism and the misunderstanding and the rejection and all that. And to put aside my doubts and concerns, which they do. I mean, they get multiplied when it comes to testifying, to use that word again, you know, to sharing and publicly communicating. Of course, I'm cautious. It's one thing that's so frustrating about people coming on with these unthought out comments / attacks, as if I haven't been wrestling with this for years and years, and as if it isn't really difficult and risky to go out on a limb and say, yeah, I think this is real.
Yeah. I mean, part of the foundation of our conditioning that all of us probably who have been drawn to your work have received is that there is no such thing. There's no such thing as what Dave's experiencing or transmitting. There's no such thing as that. And so it's exceptionally surprising, to say the least, to find that that's not true. To find that that isn't true, that we have been misled. And surely, if people are accepting that they have been misled in many things in their life, they should be open to the fact that they may well have been misled about that too.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that's the most important way that they've been misled.
Well, I've always been saying that. I mean, ever since I put pen to paper, really seriously as an adult, my what I wanted to communicate was always that what you're talking about, that thing that we've been tricked into thinking doesn't exist. Like, I only lost awareness of it for a very short period in my life, like in my movie period, my Clint Eastwood period. So from early adolescence to very early 20s, there was a period where I just kind of forgot. I believed the world when it said there isn't that. There isn't that eternal essence that's seeing us through, you know, existence always. But I found it again pretty quickly, and not in the way that Dave has apparently found it, needless to say, but enough to know what I was actually looking for. So it's ironic, again, because it's always been embedded in what I've tried to communicate, or that's always been the thing that I've tried to embed in what I communicate, is, yes, it's not about any of this other stuff. It's about this.
Whereas for me, I had no sense of it at all from very young, I would say, until I was 38 and I came to a Dave meeting. And then one of the things I said in my response to that was that I felt that there was an opportunity for my soul to exist for the first time. I didn't need to, there was no need for me to put effort into denying it. Whereas I'd spent the previous, however long, 35 years engaged in constant denial of it.
Well, that's it's quite a testimony. And of course, you've already made it. It was even the title of that podcast we did. But it's curious in the context of what I just said, because what was your response when you were following along to my output whenever I was referring to that? Did you notice, or?
I would just filter it.
Filter it out.
It was just okay, that's what Jason's, I mean, like a lot of people are saying now, okay, Jason's saying this stuff, but I'm not really going along with that. I like what Jason's saying for this bit.
So it was dispensable. You could still follow along with the other stuff, and you could just, but were you putting it on hold, or were you just saying, oh, well, he's got that bit wrong, but I can still trust in the other stuff?
Well, it was never kind of clear in that way. Our friendship didn't develop in that way. It didn't develop in a kind of partition sort of thing. I was just interested, and so I was going through a period of studying lots of different things, different people's output on the internet, and trying to figure out what's going on. And so I was open to things that I hadn't been open to before. I still do the same thing now, that with the proviso that, okay, that what somebody's saying is kind of a bit like stuff to do with a space program that not the public don't know about or something like that. You know, it's just kind of, okay, that person's saying that, but I've got nothing to corroborate what they're saying, so it's just kind of a thing that they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do anything with that information. And so that was my experience of kind of spiritual discussions, or just say, well, I can't do anything with that because I've got no way of corroborating what that person's saying. So I just kind of filter that with stuff that I can work with more practically. You know, that was the method I was using, just kind of construct my understanding was, okay, how much of what this person is saying, how much of what they're testifying to, is there, can I corroborate in any way?
Mm-hmm.
And so how reliable is what they're saying?
I'm just kind of thinking about it in the context of me shifting emphasis more and more, perhaps, onto the things that are so difficult to talk about: spiritual, eternal truths, meaning. Dave has said about himself that he's in disguise as a spiritual teacher, because that's not really what he is. And I feel as though I've been in disguise as a, you know, certainly as a movie writer, and even as a parapolitical analyst, and so on and so forth. But what's underneath the disguise, I hope it's not a spiritual teacher, because it seems like, yeah, that would be just another, you know, shoe that wouldn't fit.
Well, you're actually in disguise as Jason Horsley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's not a bad disguise. I can live with that one.
Well, in the end, you'll have to dispense with it.
Yeah.
At least you hope to be able to.
Oh, you mean before I die?
Well, if you manage to get more from Dave, or from Dave, you know.
If I manage to get enlightened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would still have to wear the disguise, though, wouldn't I?
Yeah, well, Dave does, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this is what I'm referring to, really, is what I do, or what Dave does, or pretends to do. Is he pretends to be a spiritual teacher, I pretend to be a writer and a podcaster, and then that, you know, parapolitical, paranoid aware analyst. But all of that's irrelevant as compared to what happens.
I mean, Dave pretends to be someone called Dave O'Shana, so that we have a way to relate to him, or relate to that.
Right, yeah, so that's, yeah, you have to reformat that sentence, because who or what's pretending to be Dave O'Shana?
Well, we don't know that. I don't know that.
We don't know. So, but for yourself, you were saying that you've always wanted to know what you were like outside of time. What was your face like before you were born, kind of thing. So in other words, who you are behind the disguise of Martin Jolly.
Yeah.
So you can know that. That was the only thing you could know.
What do you mean by that? The only thing I could know?
I mean, as far as knowing who or what Dave is, or who or what I am, the only reference point you'd have would be who or what you are behind the disguise. You could deduce or not deduce that the same would be true of other, you know, whatever's happenings.
That's quite intellectual, though, isn't it? It's not a sort of sensation level, which is really the level of understanding.
Well, perhaps that's the answer, though. I mean, perhaps that's what we are behind the disguises, is a sensation, which has a nice double entendre. I don't know, but I know it's a tough act to keep showing up and not really knowing why, essentially. I mean, I suppose, and what you said at the start about the cat, your neighbor's cat, and the guy on the train. How did you put it? Pulling the transmission out of you?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what I said, but something like that.
The need for attention.
Yeah.
That's the same thing I described today on our podcast, and that's why I said it was felt different when I ever talked to Dave, because I didn't feel anything in him that was pulling anything out of me. It was hard for me to respond to him because there didn't seem to be any need for attention.
But I think that's to do with Dave's hygiene, his own well-being, is that he can't give us too much attention in the way that he does on the retreat, very briefly, because it would make him very unwell, because he would start to take in too much from us, and so he has to regulate that. How much attention he gives us, because I think he would get very nauseous.
So that's an interesting take, because I had a different take on it, which was maybe more idealized, that he simply didn't need my attention. Yeah. Of course, there are lots of people in the world who don't need my attention, but generally speaking, I don't have an interaction with them. There's usually some sort of lock-on. And then...
But he doesn't need my attention or your attention, but it's more about him giving his attention. It's that he has to limit how much attention he gives to other people for his own well-being, I think.
Yeah, well, we all have to do that.
Yeah, but it's just sort of different kind of thing, different order of experience. I mean, Dave could give you more attention in 1 or 2 seconds than you get from anyone else in your whole life. Wanted to.
That's how it's felt to me. Yeah. I definitely felt that I've had that experience, like 1 or 2 seconds of Dave's attention has had a massive impact.
But you know, he is disciplined about his own hygiene, very very disciplined, and that's he's not doing that just, you know, he's very serious about that, isn't he, about his hygiene, that of what he's getting from other people. It's kind of one of the things where he becomes a lot more serious.
Yeah.
You know, he becomes a lot more firm about that kind of thing. So it obviously really does matter.
I guess that's the conditions for his spontaneity, and the spontaneity that we all get to experience on the retreat is having those very strict and clear boundaries.
Well, to be healthy, he like as he said, he has to stay healthy. He can't get sick, so he's always got that on his mind, or in his awareness.
Mm.
I mean, it's very funny to me to notice when one of the participants on the retreat did a particular stretch in the meeting area that Dave immediately had to belch to discharge what was coming off them. Tell them, thank you. You know, can you stop? I mean, Dave has a very special look when he's looking wary or in preparation for something. Or I caught it in his eyes a few times, and it was very, very memorable. Not the look of a composed center of attention, but someone who was not sure of being seen at that moment. That there was some kind of vulnerability there, physical vulnerability. That in that moment he was in a transition, so he wasn't in a prepared state.
like mine. Then your troubles will be 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 like mine.
I think Dave is almost as hard to talk about as enlightenment is hard to talk about. You know, enlightenment's impossible to talk about if you haven't experienced it, so I guess it's not quite that hard. But well, I mean, Dave is hard to talk about partly for me, maybe it's particularly with you, I don't know, but or anyone else who's, you know, really appreciates Dave, that to find a way to talk about my experience of him that isn't well, it's accurate, I suppose. I mean, I can keep it really simple, but there's specifically that doesn't veer towards kind of idealizing him, or possibly to the other. It could go the other way too, like to just have the balance right. And because I've seen sides of Dave or expressions of Dave that just seem very, very ordinary. I mean, that was my first impression of him, was how ordinary he was, in a good way. Not as in boring ordinary, but just very, very human. And sometimes, it's not very often, but it's, I think, it's maybe similar to what you're describing, like I've seen Dave blush in a Chinese restaurant when he was talking to the waitress. And it was very sweet and didn't seem any reason for him to be blushing. She hadn't said anything. It just seemed as though he just became momentarily self-conscious. And I remember I wrote that somewhere and Dave commented on it. He made a comment, something like, people might misunderstand that. And I presumed, though I didn't inquire, that he was referring to how people in the spiritual scene would see that as evidence that he couldn't really be enlightened, that he might blush in an ordinary encounter. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that was close to the context that Dave was referring to when he said people might misunderstand it. And when you describe what you described there as well, I also think, oh, people might misunderstand that, or they might interpret it a different way as evidence that, you know. And that, to me, that plays into all the misconceptions we have about enlightenment as some state. We imagine that it is something that it isn't. And with Dave, well, we can't say if he's enlightened or not because we don't really know what that word means. And he himself is like, well, I don't know. That's just the word I chose to use. So it's not really meaningful. But whatever state he's in that is qualitatively different from anyone else I've ever met, it doesn't fit most of the preconceptions I have about enlightenment, and it does seem to incorporate these very, very human kind of responses.
And this is exactly the issue that when people are saying, why is Dave charging money? Who is he if he's enlightened to be charging money? And it's exactly this issue of vulnerability, is that they are assuming in some way that he must be invulnerable, therefore this issue of him needing to protect himself or to care for himself and to care for the people he loves, that somehow he's bestowed with a need not to do that by the state he is in. But and so that thing of me saying that I noticed the way that Dave was careful about his hygiene and that he's careful about his health and so on is a recognition of his vulnerability. And only in accepting his vulnerability is it then possible to start to come to an understanding of what's really happening there instead of having these ideas about what he's supposed to be, like a pillar or a marble, like a marble statue that you pray to. And so that's where people are going immediately wrong. In sort of trying to conceptualize what's happening there, or having these associations with the idea of enlightenment. The idea of enlightenment is a statue of somebody who lived before. But Dave's a person.
Yeah, and that's reflected also in how people have been responding to my accounts of my experience, my association with Dave. I'm even wary to use the word relationship. Maybe I'm part of the problem, but somehow I feel as though that can get misinterpreted. I want to keep it businesslike. But really, my relationship with Dave, that I'm describing a relationship between two human beings, and they're responding to something else.
Yeah.
They're criticizing something else. Because of the baggage of spiritual teacher enlightenment, because of the stigma around money, charging money for something ephemeral. Well, those two main things, those are the two main things. The whole thing gets recontextualized, taken out of the human domain, and made somehow fair game for all kinds of cruel and callous critical attacks.
Yeah. I mean, it's as if there's the precondition that it cannot be coming from a person. Therefore, if we're talking about this subject matter, it's immediately not personal. And so Dave, in using the term enlightenment, has stopped being a person. And you, in then talking about it and adopting some of the terminology, you stop being a person as well. You've gone into the area of spiritual concepts, which is then fair game for sort of theological criticism.
And one of the spiritual concepts is that, yeah, when you're enlightened, you're no longer a person, which, to be fair, I mean, to be complete, Dave has inferred that.
Yes.
So it's complex.
It is complex. He's no longer an individual, but he still has a body.
He's a human being. And
human being.
With all of the feelings and the vulnerabilities and the capacity to be hurt. And I suppose I could even say the needs. Yeah, the needs. I mean, for shelter, food, and that, of course, but also for love and human warmth. Of course, he has those needs still. He's not some, you know, terminator spiritual superego. And again, like John DeRuyter is that. And the trap I fell into John DeRuyter, I mean, one of the ways, or perhaps the primary way that I really became aware of having fallen into a trap of spiritual conceptualization with John DeRuyter, was this rejection of the personal, because that's what he did. And my wife, you know, even when I met her, she'd already spent time with John DeRuyter, so she had this idea as well that we don't ever have to take anything personally, and if you take something personally, then you're, it's just ego, let's say. I'm not going to attribute that to my wife as you know, stark and reductionist as that, but that's the kind of shorthand of that sort of philosophy that is so common in spiritual circles, and certainly with my wife, it did became very painful in terms of how she did find it difficult to relate personally. You know, as most people do, especially traumatized people, and had this sort of spiritual get out clause. Whenever things did get uncomfortable emotionally, she could shift into a spiritual sort of perspective and say, well, why are you taking it personally? You know, we're not just personal or this isn't personal. And of course the counter to that or the alternative to that was impersonal. So we, even in our first getting to know each other, we talked about the impersonal relationship we had. And this is what Don DeRoos has talked about as well. You know, it was an impersonal way of being. And when I first mentioned this to Dave, when it first came up, he just said, as Dave is wont to do, he just said, "I don't know what you mean by impersonal. How can something be not personal?" And I mean, that was just the beginning of something with Dave, because my relationship with him began based on, you know, around two things. One, my relationship with my wife and how difficult it was becoming because of this dynamic. And the other was John DeRuta. And Dave gave me what John wouldn't, which was a personal relationship. And he was constantly reminding me or allowing me to see that I did have personal needs that I was just killing in the crib on a daily basis because of the situation, because it was so painful to feel them, and because I had this spiritual rationale that if I'm going to be a spiritual person, I don't have needs of this kind. I'm going to transcend these needs.
Yeah. It's a way of hiding trauma, isn't it? That kind of depersonalization.
Yeah.
The trauma that comes up in love and sex and intimacy.
Yeah.
So you're veering off intimacy into conceptual. So you're turning the love into a concept.
Yeah, and an ideal as well, like a spiritual unconditional love that... means that we're not... responsible, or we don't have to consider the other person's feelings.
I think this is a key thing here with Dave, is that it's this tension between people's association, and I suppose we can blame the ancient Greeks for this, the association between the eternal and the ideal.
Right.
And that what is Dave is transmitting is not an ideal, but it is something universal. But it's manifested in each of us in our unidealness, in our personalness, and it's getting to the root of our personalness that then reveals our sense of the eternal, not in our correlation or relationship to abstraction.
And our disowning of the personal, because that's the spiritual, cliche, and certainly in Castaneda, you've got to get rid of the personal self in order to. And yet again, there's this, it's complex because it does overlap with what Dave is saying and sharing, that there's a false self and we need to let that die.
But he's never used the word ideal. Or idealism. Not in that sense, anyway. He might have used it in terms of an analogy or a... he never talks about the ideal self, the ideal person.
No, but it is an ideal. Sorry.
Sorry.
Cut you off.
I was just saying it's something desirable.
I was saying, I mean, the idea of a true self, but he doesn't. I mean, it's language, isn't it? We'll get too tangled up if we try and unpack Dave's language, because language doesn't really refer to what is happening. But there's something there that we were getting to.
But again, this relates to these criticisms that people are having, is that they think that Dave must be dealing in ideals, and that you must be dealing in ideals, because you're talking about something transcendent. But I think that it's a complete inversion of actually where the sense of transcendence comes from. which is in feeling what is happening right now, not in what somehow that feeling what is happening right now is the way that we feel something eternal. It's strange, isn't it?
But the moment,
the present moment is our path to eternity.
And even in the body, reference to the body, which is by definition temporal, or at least that's the context that we think of the body in, as something temporal, mortal, something that will die. But don't, I mean, is it, I agree with you, not in the mental sense, but I agree with you as in I see what's happening. I think the same way, but I can see how people can make that mistake, and how even what we're talking about can be reinterpreted and recontextualized as an ideal. So I feel as though it's kind of more insidious than what you're saying, is that the mind will turn anything into an ideal. Like even what you've just said can be seen as an ideal to experience. I mean, that's Eckhart Tolle in The Power of Now, right?
Yeah, I'm aware that I've slightly overcommitted to language there, but it felt like something worth saying. But yeah, it is an overcommitment. I've committed beyond sensation there, into language. So I hope you know.
I think this is why, maybe it's partly why David's always joking the whole time, and including bad jokes.
Yeah.
I always felt with Dave, I think from very early on, that he seems committed to undermining himself every step of the way.
Yeah. I think he's acutely sensitive to whenever something is beginning to crystallize too much in language, and that he'll then cut it, undercut it, or cut across it. And that's what creates that kind of bubbling sort of rhythm of the way he's talking, where it's bubbling the mind away, because your mind is not able to rest or grasp too much.
And that's as I said, that's essential to the possibility of true spontaneity. Constantly pulling the rug out from under whatever's just happened, so that the next thing can happen fresh, can be fresh, always be fresh. And that is that's a delight to see for me, is that spontaneity, just the joy of being. And there isn't any way to communicate that except by communicating the joy of being oneself. There's no point in saying, Dave communicates the joy of being, and you should really pay some money and watch it, because it's going to be great.
Yeah. Well, there is some saying that, but yeah.
Well, maybe, yeah. Yeah. I feel this is something unfinished. I felt like we were getting to something profound. Oh, I know what it was. Maybe it wasn't profound. It was more practical, pragmatic. That, I've been trying to arrange this retreat in British Columbia so I can get the mountain to come to Muhammad. I don't have to go to Finland. And I don't think it's going to happen this year. And the main reason it's not going to happen is you can't find 8 people to commit to a retreat, a day of retreat. And I mean, talk about not ideal, you know, like I mean, Dave seems to be so committed to not fixing anything in such a way that it becomes compromised and becomes less than what it is and prevents what needs to happen to happen. So committed to spontaneity and honesty, that he can't generate a following enough to get 8 people for a retreat. And so initially on the last retreat, I was resisting the idea of trying to help Dave to reach more people, because I like it this way. And partly the reason I like it is because I see it as a measure of his integrity. But I think that that's kind of flipping it around a bit. I think that his integrity is preventing him from becoming popular, but that doesn't mean that if he became popular, it would be proof that he'd lost his integrity. I mean, that doesn't mean there isn't a way to maintain the spirit of spontaneity and for something to build around it. I just don't know what that is, and it seems that he doesn't know either, and that's what this experiment is partly this week. We're trying to get a whole bunch of people to come. And it seems as though more people coming via me to show up to his event than would show up to an event I hosted. So that's a weird irony. Like, I can't get more than 20 people. I can't get more than 10 people to come to a Zoom meeting. But there's probably 20 or 30 that have signed up for Dave's meeting via me. So there's a weird irony there. When I try and get people to come to what I'm doing, I can't do it as well as trying to get them to come to Dave's thing.
To be fair, I mean, he is offering something slightly more I'm not sure what the word is, but I mean, he's enlightened, right? So
I wasn't going to rescue you there. I was just too curious to hear what the word was going to be. I was going to say rarefied was what I would have said. But most of the people coming via me don't believe he's enlightened, I don't suppose. I mean, I hope they don't, because they don't know, right? So, but, you know, they're curious, so they, like, I don't know who, I can't say what's motivating them. I think it is an ironic, not just an irony, I think maybe it indicates something. That people, there is a natural resistance to self-promotion. And more than just that, there's more stuff going on there, but then there's that Dave does self-sabotage, or not self-sabotage, because that's neurotic, but he undermines what he's doing as seemingly as an expression of his own enjoyment of what he's doing. He makes himself laugh somehow at the whole thing of being a parody of a guru, I think. And that is it's only going to attract either people who can discern how rare and unique that is in and of itself, which would be people like you or I, who are kind of sophisticated and trained and skeptical and like find that refreshing, or people who he's mostly attracted, I think, are people who just look past all of that and just have a visceral sense of something happening. And they follow that.
Yeah.
Don't you know we've all got hidden treasures? Do you remember such a time? Before it was a sin to call yourself a dreamer, and treasure was a thing. Bury in the woods where no one goes, hidden in a sailor's chest of oak, in a place where only you would know. Promise me that you
hotter. I wanna see your silver shine under the moon one night, carved in alabaster. I wanna see your treasure shine, not buried in the woods where no one goes, hidden in a sailor's chest of old, in a place where only you would know. Sunken treasures down at the bottom of the blue. But Poseidon, he can keep it there forever, 'cause I can see the gold in you, buried in the sea a league below, hidden in a sailor's chest of oak, in a place where only you would know. Buried in the woods where no one goes, hidden in a sailor's chest of oak, in a place where you and only you could know.
I think there's another element to that too, which is the aversion to becoming a commodity that is inherent in being popular. Or commercial, is that you accept that for most of the people who are consuming your work, that you are a commodity for them. And so I had that experience when I was younger, and I was, I had an exhibition of my paintings and people were offering to buy them, and I didn't want to sell any of them because I had an aversion to the sensation that this thing that I'd made to share something was going to become a commodity. And so I don't know what the proper balance of that is. Obviously Dave has come to some balance where he's saying, okay, I can commodify to a certain extent even to make this thing happen, in order to charge for my time and so on, in order to make this kind of lifestyle possible. But it's only just possible, isn't it? It's not as if he's making a great deal of money doing it. So he's only just made it possible. And perhaps that's as far as he can go. Just possible is as far as he can go into it, and no further.
Well, so far.
Yeah, I mean, if he did become very popular, or much more popular, it would be something that happened, not something that was designed. It would be because people came to him rather than because he constructed some strategy for making it happen, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree, but I think that's might be too finely drawn a dichotomy, at least in my own experience, because nothing happens without us doing stuff, even if we can't say that I do something and I make it happen, still when something happens, how it happens is through human beings moving and acting in the world, right? So the happening itself does involve us doing stuff, even if it's not causal in that way. And so for me, I mean, the counterpoint for me would be selling books. And I've never been able to promote my books until recently. And the only reason I have been able to recently, it seems to me, and it hasn't made a huge difference, I don't think, is that I've really started to own their value. I've really started to allow myself to believe in the value of what I do. And so then the promoting just becomes more than a strategy to get the books to sell. It just becomes a way for me to, it's like a parent who praises their children, right? They're not trying to get anything out of it. It's just they feel proud of their children, so they want to let people know, you know, an expression of that. And so I think that, I mean, I can't speak for Dave. I wouldn't dare in this regard, but maybe there is some ambivalence in him. It would be odd if there wasn't. Certainly for me, there's been so much ambivalence about becoming popular that I have undermanned myself. And at this point, I do feel as though what you just said, that if I were ever to become popular, it wouldn't be because of any strategy on my part, it would just happen. But I also think that would be inseparable from me just becoming more and more comfortable with who I am and my output and even the idea or the possibility of being successful.
So you wouldn't thwart it. You wouldn't thwart it as a sort of momentum gradually built. And
yeah. But I also wouldn't be seeking it. I wouldn't be pushing for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, practically speaking, as far as Dave's concerned, and myself too, in different ways, perhaps, with the books. I mean, let's say the books, there is value in those books that is not being maximized. The potential isn't being realized in terms of those books and how many people they could reach and assist, let's say, in some small way. And same with Dave, obviously. And although I wouldn't want to ever see him on Oprah Winfrey, I would like to be able to set up a retreat in my own town and have enough people come to it to make it work, right? And so at least a little bit more, you know, could happen just to make something possible that currently isn't possible. I mean, of course, that can go all the way to wanting to, you know, be on Oprah Winfrey and will awaken the whole world. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I feel I've always been at this point. So maybe one does always end up staying at it. I don't know. But like, I don't want big success. I just want just enough success to be able to do what I want to do. And I don't mean have lots of parties and lots of, you know, strip dancers come out of my wedding cake or anything that kind. I just mean so I could carry on writing books or whatever it was. Right now I don't know what it is. Right now it's to bring Dave to British Columbia, and in the case of Dave, it seems clear that he can't be as effective as he could be if he was just a little bit more popular.
I think one of the things though is that there's such a high barrier of entry to even noticing what's happening with Dave. And Dave is waiting, it seems to me at least, for signs that people are noticing, and that's kind of the prerequisite for him to then start engaging with people. By inherently, in the nature of people, not many people will be able to do that. will have the space or the capacity or the sensitivity to notice it. So it is a very rare thing. It is a very rare thing, I think. So it's not only that Dave has what he has, it's that other people also need to cooperate with it. So he's waiting for that cooperation, at least some sign of it, before he then starts to invest himself. So if you wanted to spread that further, you would need to come up with a method for putting people in a state where they could be more cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
So that they would have the feeling of space. That they would be sensitive to what's happening within themselves to start noticing.
Yeah, and that's why the retreat is the real game with Dave, or the context that is necessary to really experience what happens with Dave is the retreat, because only on the retreat are you fully in that space where you can let go.
But the sad thing is that even in the retreat, it's limited. It's limited by the structure and the circumstances and the time. So even there, it's still, I felt really that there was still a kind of, it wasn't an ideal, to go back to the question of ideal, wasn't an ideal method for absorbing. Perhaps there is no such thing. You know, there is no such thing. Only the things that are happening.
Well, there's different degrees. I mean, one could have a year-long retreat.
Yeah. But then we come back to Dave's finiteness as a person. His limitations as a person. His hygiene and so on. His well-being.
I think one thing we didn't touch on and around the objections to Dave, and maybe we did touch on it with the patriarchy and all that, but that just the idea of something centering around one person is offensive to people.
Yeah.
But I think it's also objectionable to Dave. I mean, I think he also doesn't see that as the optimal arrangement.
Yeah, and there are attempts by participants to generalize, to generalize out from their experiences with Dave to something more universal or not personal to Dave. And there is something in that, in the sort of group meetings that we have, we do experience something from each other, which we don't get from Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience, wonderful feeling. But that doesn't deny the fact that he's by far the most potent emitter. You know, he's by far the brightest star in the sky, by far.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we really want guidance, we have to still keep coming back to that, at least at the moment.
As long as it's in the sky, you're going to orientate yourself by it. That's probably a good analogy, because if you get to know the other stars in the sky, then at any time the brightest star is not visible. By that time, you can still navigate, because it's helped you get to know the, you know, configuration of the stars in the larger sense. And of course, the brightest star in the sky isn't necessarily the biggest or the closest or anything. It just happens to be the brightest. No? There isn't a hierarchy in that. We can create a hierarchy out of it. And that's a danger, again, that I think Dave is always addressing and neutralizing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm the proof of it, as I wrote in the last blog post, that I was able to leave the Dave project more or less gracefully or graciously, more or less, and feel good about it, and come back a couple of years later and just pick up where I left off. To me, that proves to my satisfaction that it's not really about Dave in the sense that, you know, the undiscerning, skeptical, cynical perspective immediately goes to the cult of personality model.
Yeah.
And not entirely wrongly, in the sense that 999 times out of 1,000, when this happens in the world, that's what it is. But still, kind of baby out with the bathwater, selling themselves short by ruling out the possibility that one time in 1,000 it might not be that. Because then they rule out the possibility for themselves.
Exactly. Exactly. What they're really ruling out is that they might have this within themselves. And that's really what you're trying to communicate. It's not that everyone should follow Dave, but rather it's possible for you to feel very differently. And this is how I've managed to feel differently.
Mm.
That's really what you want to happen, what I would like to happen. I want people to feel it for themselves. I mean, I admire Dave deeply for having shared that with me, for having managed to do it first himself. It's extraordinary. But I realize that the thing that stays with me is my own transmission.
Hmm.
Not him.
Standing on a city street corner, everybody says he's a loner. He's passing a hat and singing a song about a one-way ticket to Tahiti.
It's funny, isn't it? I always feel like I've said too much because with respect to Dave, because I can start to feel that I'm just getting into things that will just be contradicted, that it was almost not worth saying at a certain point, because really it didn't really get to anything.
Is part of that imagining how other people might hear it and interpret it?
Yeah, that I can imagine. I can imagine that people would get fixed on things that we've said or that I've said, and miss really actually what we are trying to communicate. And it's so hard to pass on just by talking. The feeling. It's like you'd have to cook for somebody to really pass it on. Cook them a nice meal and say, oh, this is really what it's about. It's the taste of the meal and the feeling of somebody having cooked for you and their hospitality, and it's all those things, you know. And then the conversation you have as you're eating, which is the conversation we've just had now, that's part of it. But the other part of it was the feeling of the food in your stomach and a kind of flavor that you wouldn't cook for yourself. Mm-hmm. That delight. I mean, we have a tendency, you know, to go into too much kind of rational processing and subtle language, and you know, Dave, you wouldn't have any of that.
Well, he said in an email recently that you would be a good PR person for him, so I think he does appreciate the way that you try and articulate your experiences around him, particularly, I would say. We'll edit that bit out.
Yeah, he hasn't said that to me. So.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, some of the best conversations that I've done for the podcast have been the ones that are most groping, where there's the most acute awareness at the time of, have I said too much, or have I not said enough, or I, you know, because that does communicate that this is something that's beyond language, but we're going to try anyway.
Yeah,
because otherwise there'd be no podcast. So something can be conveyed with the failure as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important to communicate that this was a failure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
A happy one.
Yeah. But we failed.
Well, we might have failed at something, but we might have succeeded at something else. We succeeded in having a conversation and catching up and sharing some love and camaraderie.
Yeah.
But if we were trying to encapsulate Dave on the Enlightenment transmission, we would have known that was doomed from the start. So.
Yeah. I don't think we really tried, to be honest. I tried to just say the things that came to me and that seemed most sort of lucid at the time. Perhaps that's how Dave does it.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore. These words, these words. These words, these words are yours. I know they all come from long ago and only resonate now. But it's hard to tell which thoughts are my own when I keep hearing everyone else. I keep hearing everyone else. I won't listen. I won't listen anymore. these words. These words are yours. These words. These words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice.